This is an encore presentation of the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. On this week's program, landmines don't just kill and maim. In Colombia, they cause starvation.
Hay mucha gente que está atrapada todavía.
There's lots of people that are still trapped in the middle of the mines. They can't move either left or right or up or down. There's a lot of people who are eating, as they say, water and salt.
Plus, when getting an education isn't enough, college graduates in Morocco can't find jobs.
You look yourself growing up. You imagine yourself a doctor, an engineer, a teacher, okay? But when you finish your studies, you find yourself suddenly in the streets. So the mirror, the looking glass is broken down.
And we get a taste of the momo. It's a traditional Tibetan dumpling. First this news. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymire. The civil war in Colombia has dragged on for 40 years. The conflict between rebel groups and government forces makes life difficult for the civilian population, especially those living in rural areas. Take the story of Dagoberto Irawa. One morning in March, Dagoberto set out from his small village and headed to a neighboring town. He wanted to sell a mule. His family needed the money. Even so, they pleaded with him not to go. Just months before, rebels had littered the surrounding countryside with landmines. Conrad Fox reports from southern Colombia.
There have been landmines hidden in the fields and roads of this mountainous region for years. The crudely made but powerful devices are placed by the left-wing rebel group, the National Liberation Army, or ELN for its initials in Spanish. The group uses the mines to keep government forces at bay, and until recently, locals knew where most of them were planted. But a few months ago, the Colombian army began attacking the ELN. Desperate, the rebels planted ever more mines, most of them unmarked. Now, for locals, a simple trip like Dagoberto's, to sell a mule, has become all but impossible. His friend, Edgar Narváez, picks up the story.
Possiblemente a las cinco de la tarde debía de estar.
He was due back around 5 in the afternoon,
pero no llegó.
But he never turned up.
Algunos trabajadores habían escuchado eso de la una de la... De la tarde,
some workers said that around 1 o'clock, they heard a mine explode.
La familia ya comenzó a angustiarse y me dice, usted
the family begged me,
acompañarnos.
You've got to help us look for him.
Para mí era algo muy duro.
For me, that was hard.
Sumamente duro.
Really, really hard.
Yo sabía que estábamos arriesgando la vida.
I knew we were risking our lives.
Reluctantly, Narváez joined the family in retracing Dagoberto's steps. They drove two mules in front of them, hoping that if they crossed a mine, the animals would trip it before they did. After several hours walking through the forest, their fears were confirmed.
Miramos un galoncito de café que había llevado como.
We saw a thermos of coffee that Dagoberto had taken.
Alto por allá unos 6 metros, alto en un árbol, encontramos una camisa. Estaba allí.
Way up in a tree there was a shirt, as if someone had hung it there.
Una hija, Rosa, se metió sobre el bosque y pronto dijo, aquí está mi papá.
His daughter, Rosa, walked off in the woods. Here's my dad, she called out.
Estaba muerto. Muchas partes de su cuerpo ya no estaban.
He was dead. Lots of his body parts were just missing.
According to the Ottawa-based organization World Landmine Monitor, Colombia has the highest rate of mine-related accidents in the world. Last year, 193 people were killed by landmines in Colombia. In Nariño, the problem is now so severe, it has brought normal life to a standstill. Narváez says that in his community, many farmers are afraid to work their fields. In others, people are afraid to leave their houses.
The army was getting closer and closer, and the guerrillas were mining the road. That's when I started to get scared.
This man is a teacher at a rural school in the heart of ELN-controlled territory. He doesn't want his name used, or the name of his village, for fear of reprisals from the rebels. In January, when the army began closing in on the village, he and his neighbors were unable to leave, or to receive food from outside. For 3 weeks, they survived on nothing but rice and bananas. When even that ran out, they had no choice but to risk walking across the minefield to get food.
There were 30 of us, carrying our backpacks, a few clothes.
Todos mudos.
All of us quiet, 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 praying to God none of us stepped on a mine. I got to go at the back of the group.
After 4 hours, they reached a town outside the conflict zone. They were lucky, he says.
There's lots of people that are still trapped in the middle of the mines. They can't move either left or right or up or down. There's a lot of people who are eating, as they say, water and salt, and that's it.
According to municipal authorities, some 3,400 people in the conflict zone are unable to leave their communities or get food transported in. Information about the conditions in the communities is sketchy. There are no land telephone lines, and rebels forbid the use of cell phones within their territory. The best place for news is here, in the busy main square of Samaniego, a town outside the conflict zone. While locals chat in the open-air cafes and food stalls, a few campesinos from affected communities shop for supplies. Like the schoolteacher, most of them have walked out on back trails, where mines are less likely. This man, who won't give his name, says it took 2 days to walk from his village. He says that back home, there's not much left to eat.
Pues ahorita de los productos que se dan allá, como la yuca, el chiro, el maíz.
Just what we can grow there. Yucca, banana, corn, sugarcane. We used to be able to fish and hunt, but because the mines are everywhere, we can't even do that. Since the roads were closed, we can't feed our kids like they need to be. They're getting tired and malnourished and sick.
But tomorrow he's going back. He says the rebels have told him and his neighbors that if they don't return soon, their lands will be confiscated. 15 miles away in the village of El Decio, Major Javier León of the Colombian Army talks to a group of campesinos. They're from communities deep in the conflict zone. 2 days ago, the campesinos walked 8 hours on a back route to buy supplies in Samaniego. Now they're trying to get home on the main road. Thanks to demining, they've made it this far in a rented truck. The major says the road is clear for another mile or so from here, but beyond that, he gives no guarantees.
Dígale no a la coca y cultiven cositas que realmente ustedes puedan sacar con orgullo sin ningún problema, ¿okay?
Most of the campesinos, including Rubia Álvarez, are willing to risk the minefields to get back home.
Pues yo me siento bien y doy gracias a Dios de que sí voy a llegar.
I feel okay about it, she says.
A reunirme con mi hijo allá.
I just thank God I'm going to be home and will be with my child soon. When the major finishes talking, the campesinos cram into the back of their truck. They drive up a tortuous mountain road towards home, but are stopped at numerous army checkpoints. At the last one, soldiers warn them they will have to cross on foot a small village deserted weeks ago by its inhabitants. The houses and streets here are booby-trapped with explosives. There's a grim silence as they get down from the truck. 5 minutes from here, they can see the village, where even the army is afraid to go. Word arrives from a local farmer that we are being watched by ELN fighters from a hideout less than half a mile away. Finally, one man calls out, "Let's go." "To everyone his own saint," says another. In single file, they head briskly down the road, avoiding my microphone. Talking to a journalist can be risky if the rebels find out. I try to ask a question of Rubia Álvarez. I can't talk now, she says frantically. Get the microphone away. Within a few minutes, the group snakes its way through the empty streets of the village, then rounds a bend and is out of sight, beyond the help of the army. For the World Vision Report, I'm Conrad Fox in Nariño State, Colombia.
Journalists often find themselves in dangerous situations. Rob Crilly is a reporter with the Christian Science Monitor. He told us about a special training session he attended in London on how to report from a war zone. The sessions are led by British Royal Marine Commandos.
The first thing they teach you is a huge amount of first aid because people do get injured in these situations, and very often it's the first few minutes that can make the difference in saving someone's life. Obviously, the other thing they teach you is how to make sure that you're not a target. So it's keeping your eyes open for things out of the ordinary that might suggest something nasty is about to happen. So it's all sorts of things that you might encounter in a combat zone. And very often there are no easy answers to what you might do in these circumstances. But what these guys are trying to teach you is that, first of all, you should go in prepared, which is something the most journalists don't think about. They pick up their notebook and run.
Can you share with us any of the things about preparation that that you've learned that might not be so obvious? How would a journalist prepare other than, I mean, it's interesting that you say some journalists just go in taking their notepads. I would think they'd be a little more prepared in a war zone.
Mm-hmm. Well, there are certain things that you might do when traveling in a war zone. As a journalist, you might think it was sensible to go into an area wearing a flak jacket, body armor, for example. But in certain circumstances, it could actually make you a target. In Somalia, for example, it has been known for people just to walk up to a journalist wearing a flak jacket and test their AK-47. You know, is this really a bulletproof jacket? So there are lots of things that you might think are a good idea in a war zone, which could be counterproductive. For another example might be if you're reporting on right at the front line on fighting, you might take cover behind a wall, just perhaps sometimes looking around it to get an idea of what's going on. But of course, that is exactly what a sniper would be doing, tucked away in a corner, just peering around the corner. So under other circumstances, it might be better to dress in bright clothing and to stand right in the middle of things and make it obvious what you're doing.
Rob, did you ever imagine that you'd go into this kind of reporting when you got into journalism, or did you just kind of stumble into it?
Yeah, no, I mean, I had no intention of doing it whatsoever. I would much prefer to be sitting somewhere comfortable with a mug of cocoa, writing up my nice colour pieces from a distance. But I had an interest in Africa, and before long I realised that within my patch were some pretty hot areas, and there was no way you can really cover the stories properly without going there. And sometimes, inevitably, whatever protection you might take, you can end up in the line of fire. So it's one of these things that I suppose I wandered into, and now I'm trying to make sure that I'm fully equipped to deal with it. It's always at the back of your mind, and I think we're all guilty, perhaps, of thinking we're invincible sometimes, that it's not going to happen to us. And, the courses like this are invaluable in teaching you that it can happen to you, but there are things that you can do to try and reduce the risks and maximize your chances of survival if that million to one bullet does hit you.
All right, Rob, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Great, thanks very much.
Rob Crilly is a journalist with the Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from London. Coming up, jobs, jobs, jobs. It's what everyone's talking about these days, even in Morocco. More on that after a short break. This is the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Waymeyer. The jobless rate rose last month at 9.5%. It's the highest in 26 years. News of layoffs continue to fill the headlines. And a college education is no hedge against unemployment. The same is true in Morocco. Thousands of educated young people in the North African country have master's and PhD degrees, but they have no work. Sarah Kramer reports from Rabat.
The call to prayer is a familiar sound on Boulevard Mohammed V in downtown Rabat. But in the past few years, this has also become a recurring sound. It's the chants of the unemployed, who protest daily outside Morocco's parliament building. There are also the whistles of the riot police who try, sometimes violently, to break up the demonstrations. The protesters belong to a group called Al-Fateya, which means fresh. They're united by a common problem. All hold master's or PhD degrees, yet they can't find jobs. They've studied things like geography, history, physics, and Islamic law. But some have been out of work for years.
To translate this, it means that Parliament and the government, the parliaments and the governments are deeply asleep. And the unemployed are in deep crisis. Yet, no one could awake.
Abdelhak Ramawi, one of the protesters, has a master's degree in English literature. He thought it would prepare him for a career in translation, journalism, or teaching. But after graduation, he found only temporary work as an assistant teacher for pitiful pay. He took the job, but it wasn't enough to live on, so he also worked on the streets as a palm reader. After 2 years of this, he says he's devastated.
You look yourself growing up. You imagine yourself a doctor, an engineer, a teacher, okay? But when you finish your studies, you find yourself suddenly in the streets. So the mirror, the looking glass is broken down.
The Moroccan government says the current unemployment rate is under 10%. But for Moroccans with advanced degrees, that unemployment statistic jumps to 21%. And that doesn't take into account the underemployed, those who've given up on finding jobs in professional fields. The protesters are demanding the government create jobs for them. But Samir Ajram of the Moroccan Ministry of Employment argues that the future lies elsewhere.
Il y a une réorientation pour encourager l'emploi dans le secteur privé. Il y a une réorientation.
There has been a reorientation to encourage work in the private sector, a reorientation to stimulate the creation of enterprises, because it is in this way the economy must develop. This is where growth will give more opportunities for employment. So people must opt for the private sector.
The Al-Fateya group also protests regularly outside the Ministry of Education. Each time an employee is allowed inside, the group tries to storm the building, but the gate is slammed shut. The protesters say universities are partly to blame for their unemployment. With little career counseling, the majority choose to study the humanities. This while engineers and IT experts are in such high demand in Morocco that some companies are importing foreign workers with those skills. Hussein Kachau of the Ministry of Employment agrees there's a problem.
To send the majority of students into higher education and train them to be academics so that they find themselves faced with a job market that doesn't require their competence, therein lies the problem. In my opinion, we need a reform of the higher educational system to define what we want and how we will obtain it.
Meanwhile, Boulevard Mohamed V has become an employment office of sorts. Public protesting has actually turned into a way to land a government job. Abdelhak Ramawi, the guy with the English literature degree, says the government often placates protesters by finding them work.
I have many friends who got jobs via this contesting match. I become convinced that this is the only pathway which leads to get a job.
To its credit, the government is looking for a longer-term solution than just hiring a few of the loudest protesters. It's recently developed a program to connect graduates with prospective employers. But Al-Fateya doubts that the initiative will be ambitious enough to help the thousands who are jobless. Until then, they're on the streets. For the World Vision Report, this is Sarah Kramer in Rabat, Morocco.
In towns across Morocco, the call to prayer mingles with music from the street, especially this tune from Morocco's top 10.
تعرفوش song's called Ya Taibni. It's by Tamer Hosni. He's a singer, actor, and composer from Egypt. Olga Murray is 83 years old. She's well past retirement age, so this former attorney wouldn't be faulted for taking long vacations or working in her garden. But she's not. Olga Murray heads up an organization that rescues destitute children in Nepal. She got the idea when she was mountain trekking with friends in Nepal.
I saw children there, the likes of which I had never seen before. They were extremely poor, dressed literally in rags, most of them malnourished, and the happiest kids I have ever seen. Curious, funny, smart. And what they all wanted to do was go to school. At that time, most Nepali children did not attend school. And I just had sort of an epiphany. I thought, all right, this is what I'm going to do with the rest of my life.
So you had this incredible idea that you see these kids, you're trekking, and this is the project I want to take on. But how did you actually do it?
In 1987, I went back with some friends and I broke my leg on a trek. And I was carried in a basket over the mountains for 8 days. And the leg was set by a young doctor who had just opened a small hospital for children with orthopedic problems. And I was there one day and he asked me into his examining room. And there was this beautiful 13-year-old girl sitting on the examining table. And he said to me, you know, she would like to go to school in Kathmandu, but she has nobody to live with. Do you know somebody she could live with? And I said, well, I'm a tourist. I don't know anybody she could live with, but I could send her to boarding school. And that opened the floodgates. Please send so-and-so and so. Please send so-and-so to boarding school. And that's how our program started. We now have, let's see, we have about 3,500 children under scholarship throughout the country from kindergarten to medical school.
And you started this when you were 60. Do you mind me asking how old you are now?
83.
83, and you're doing this full time.
Oh, yes, more than full time. I say I'm busier than when I work for money. And I live 6 months a year in California and 6 months a year in Kathmandu.
Well, let's go back to the children. During your time in Nepal, you were funding scholarships, but you also learned that girls in rural areas were having a very difficult time getting an education. What concerned you in particular about the way families were treating their daughters?
It turns out that there are five districts in western Nepal where an ethnic group called the Taru bond their daughters away as servants. The father gets an average of $50 a year for his daughter's labor. She doesn't get anything. And her working conditions are entirely at the mercy of her employer.
How often does this actually happen?
We thought 20 to 25,000 is what we estimated initially. Now, maybe 10 to 15,000 left. We have rescued over 4,000 girls already. And our aim is just to eradicate this custom altogether, and so far we've done very well.
Why are they selling their young daughters?
For two reasons. First of all, they're extremely poor, and sometimes that $50 a year they get is the only income they have. They have other children to feed, and girls, women and girls in Nepal are not treated well at all, and they're not valued. Somebody told me an Indian saying one time, bringing up a girl is like watering your neighbor's garden, because a girl goes off to live with her husband's family and her obligations are no longer to her own family, whereas the boys stay with the family. So it's a combination of a practice that was very common in their society and poverty.
Did you meet many of these children who had been bonded out as servants, domestic help?
Oh, many, many. It's very sad. The first time I was there, I was really shocked. I thought these would be 15, 16, 17-year-old girls, but they're not. They're little, tiny, defenseless girls who've never been away from home before. There was all kinds of abuse going on. I'm absolutely sure they did whatever their employers told them to.
You came up with a better idea for their parents, I understand.
That's right, a better idea for their parents. And in this program, not one rupee changes hands, not one rupee. These labor contractors come to buy the girls. They go to a father and they say, oh, I know a family in Kathmandu who needs a servant. Let me take your girl and I'll give you $50. That's about what it comes to. And at first we thought we'd say, how much did you get from the labor contractor for your daughter? Here's the money, release her. But they nosed around the village and the women said, whatever you do, do not give our husbands money.
Why is that?
They'd spend it on alcohol. And so between the mothers, and we have a very, very good staff over there, and our staff, we discovered that they loved pork products. So we said, what if we gave you a baby piglet, and you can raise a pig, and you can sell it at the end of the year for about the same amount of money that you got for your daughter?
And they responded well to that. They thought that was a good deal.
They thought that was a good deal. In the meantime, we will be responsible for her education. We will put her in school. We will keep her in school. We will pay all school-related expenses. And so that first year, it was starting with 32 girls in January 2000. And now 4,000 girls have been rescued. The girls are all in school. We keep them in school through high school. And that's only part of the program, but the girls themselves have formed themselves, the returned girls, into clubs. And if they find out that a father is about to sell his daughter in the village, they go to him in their school uniforms and say, why are you doing this to your daughter?
I can imagine it's made an enormous difference in the lives of these girls. When you think of the program, does any one girl come to mind, anyone's story that you'd like to share with us?
Oh, we have one girl who I'm particularly fond of. Her name is Shiva. She's a beautiful, beautiful young girl. And she had worked for several years for a kind of a mean family. And they beat her. They hardly fed her. And when her employer tried to sexually abuse her, she told her mother. And we had already started our program. And she joined our program. And she's in college now. And she's studying journalism so she can fight this custom.
Now, Olga, I have to ask you, I know a lot of people must ask you this. You worked as an attorney on the West Coast up until your 60s.
Yes.
And now you have this whole new career in your 80s. How do they compare?
Oh, I just keep saying I got the best dotage of anybody I know. It's a different kind of satisfaction that I get now, you know, knowing that we're helping kids all the time with our scholarships, and then we're liberating these girls.
So you've still got your work cut out for you.
We've got our work cut out for us.
Olga Murray, thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Oh, you're very welcome. I enjoyed the interview.
Olga Murray is the founder of the Nepalese Youth Opportunity Program. She spoke to us from California. If Olga Murray had traveled farther south, she could have tasted a Tibetan delicacy called momo. Tibetans love momos. They're little steamed dumplings, similar to Chinese potstickers, and they're very popular in McLeod Ganj, India. That's where many Tibetans live in exile. Reporter Peter Aronson brings us the latest in our What's Cooking series.
My neighbor Sangye Tashi gives cooking classes to tourists. So, enticed by the smells emanating from his kitchen and the satisfied look on the faces of those he teaches, I decided to sign up. I wanted to learn how to make those tasty Tibetan dumplings called momos. I'm joined by two Israelis, four French people, and a Swiss woman.
So today we're going to make four kind of momos. Spinach with cheese and mixed vegetable momos and potato momo and chocolate momo. Chocolate momo, yeah.
For the vegetable momos, Sangye mixes shredded cabbage and carrots in a bowl with his bare hand.
Are these the same vegetables that you would use in Tibet?
Here. Those all we can get in Tibet. But this too, garlic and ginger, we don't use it. Because some ingredients I cannot get like in Tibet.
As with so much of Tibetan exile culture, inevitably new flavors and influences slip in, like Indian spices or masalas. But Sangye never uses them in his classes because they're not authentically Tibetan.
So some of the restaurants are using Indian masala?
Yeah, masala. They use masala. Also, you know, some people, they don't know what we use in Tibet. Many Tibet people were born in India. They didn't know about Tibet culture. Some, like us, we're coming from Tibet, so we know our life in Tibet. Slowly.
Next, we use rolling pins to roll little balls of dough into circles for the momo skins.
Yeah, like this, slowly turn around.
And as the Dalai Lama looks on from a poster hanging above the table, Sangye fills me in on momo variations around the world.
China, they have momo, kind of momo, not the same. And Japanese, they have momo. And Korean, they have kind of momo. And also in Italian, they say the ravioli. Like momo, so... But some students came to here. They think momo is coming from China. But I told them, who knows, momo is coming from China or momo is going to from the to Tibet. So, and Tibet is not part of China.
Which is an important point to note around here, even when you're making momos. Next, we make the filling for the chocolate momos.
Actually, you know, chocolate momo is not traditional of Tibet. Yeah, that's true. But in East Tibet, my place, so we make a tsampa momo.
Tsampa is roasted barley flour, a Tibetan staple food. In sweet momos, they mix it with raisins, honey, and walnuts.
So you're putting the spinach and cheese filling in with a spoon?
Yeah. Okay, so...
Finally, we put the various fillings into the momo skins, which have flour on one side but are sticky on the other. We carefully pinch and twist them into respectable-looking momos, and then place them all in an aluminum steamer. And finally...
It's really good.
You like it?
Yeah.
I think it's good, but it was mine, so it's very good. It was my momo. I have to find my momo.
So I'm going to try one of the spinach momos with a little bit of chili. And is this soy sauce?
Yeah, soy sauce.
Oh, it squirted out juice.
Mm.
That's really good.
Yeah, it's really good. With spinach with cheese, it's best.
Well, for the World Vision Report, I'm Peter Aronson, slightly spattered with spinach juice in McLeod Ganj, India.
Oh, this potato one.
Coming up on the World Vision Report, a professional baseball player creates a field of dreams in the Dominican Republic. Find out more after the break. Welcome back to the World Vision Report. I'm Peggy Way Meyer. Dave Valley lived what many young boys only dream of. He played baseball in the big leagues. He was a catcher for the Seattle Mariners. In the winter, he played ball in sunnier spots. One year, he was in the Dominican Republic when he saw something that would change the direction of his life. He was at a bus stop with his wife and baby son.
I was in my dirty, sweaty, smelly uniform and waiting for the bus, and all of a sudden... kids started coming all around us, and that's something that's not very unusual outside of a ballpark, but there was a difference. These kids were all shoeless, most of them were shirtless, and they weren't looking for autographs. They were looking for food to survive the night. And as I was standing there holding my little four-month-old boy, I just could not imagine him ever being in that same situation. So that night, there was a lady that was cooking some fried chicken and some sweet potatoes. So my wife and I went over and just asked her to cook up everything she had and to hand it out to all the kids. So we did that, and we were on the bus heading back to the capital of Santo Domingo. And I just realized, I said, you know, what did we just do? You know, maybe we helped them for the next 4 hours, but in 4 hours, they're going to be hungry again. So that night, my wife and I made a commitment that if we were ever in a position to come back and do something and make a difference, that we would do that.
I take it you had to go back to, you were with the Seattle Mariners there then, right?
Well, at that point, it was early in the winter ball season, and I believe it was in November, and I was there from November, December, and January. From that moment on, my eyes seemed to have just been opened to this whole world that was out there outside my bus. Every time I was driving from town to town, and you're looking down the side streets, and you're seeing all of these kids. It wasn't just outside that one ballpark. It was in every town, every community that we passed where children just didn't have anything. Not that I hadn't seen poverty before. Growing up in New York City, I've been all over the city, Harlem and Bed-Stuy and Brownsville and different areas, but not to the scale that I saw down there.
Did you relate at all to these kids from what you grew up with?
I did. And I grew up in New York City, and I grew up in a very large family, 8 children. My mom and dad raised us in Queens, and I was number 7 in that batting order for that team. And my dad, at the age of 41, died of a massive heart attack. So seeing the situation that my mother had to go through, fortunately, she was able to find work, and she worked the graveyard shift at Flushing Hospital in New York City. So she'd leave the house at about 10:30, work from 11 to 7. My oldest brother was 15 at the time, so he was kind of given charge of the house to make sure we didn't burn it down while she was gone. She'd come home with some rolls and butter, feed us breakfast, send us off to school. And I realize now, you know, I just don't even know when my mom ever actually slept with all the things that she had to do to take care of 8 children. I can't imagine the, you know, the financial situation, always having, whether it was milk or bread, but she kept us fed.
It seems as though after your dad died, baseball almost became a singular passion for you.
It was. My dad played kind of semi-pro in the New York City area. He was actually a catcher as well, but just loved the game of baseball. And it was something that I really loved. And I think, you know, in life, there are certain things that will catch our eye, but there are very few things that really catch your heart. And for me, baseball caught my heart, and I pursued it.
Well, it sounds like when you were playing baseball in the Dominican Republic, those kids caught your heart too and kind of changed, not changed your direction necessarily, but you started a dual career in a way, didn't you?
Those kids did. They did capture my heart. And God really placed this seed in our life at that time that we had no idea what that would lead to.
Let's talk about what that did lead to. You went back years later, and you did more than just feed these kids a big dinner one night. What are you doing in the Dominican Republic now?
Well, in 1995, our response to that commitment we made 10 years earlier was Esperanza International. And Esperanza is a holistic ministry that serves the poorest of the poor in the Dominican Republic and Haiti. For instance, we built computer technology and learning centers. We created the Esperanza Medical Clinic, and we provide a small loan to the poor, microfinance. That loan is about $150, depending on the exchange rate at the time. We will then train the people and give them an opportunity to start their own business. To me, microfinance, the most powerful thing about it is that it unleashes the God-given potential in every person that receives it. When you're living on $2 a day or less, you're worried about the next meal. You're not worried about next year. You're not dreaming about your child's education. You're thinking about, how do I get through today? Microfinance gives people the opportunity to dream again.
What kind of difference is it making in the Dominican Republic?
I'll tell you a story of somebody. Her name is Milan. I first met Milan about 8 years ago. She heard about Esperanza through some friends and decided she was going to take a chance and receive a loan. So with her first loan, she bought an old sewing machine. She was making specialized clothing for the girls in the neighborhood, maybe for communions or birthday parties. So her business started to grow very well. Well, Milan's love was children. And she found this young boy, 8 years old, that had been abandoned, an orphan on the street, and she took him into her house and found out that he didn't know how to read and write. So Milan started to teach him how to read and write. Very soon in the neighborhood, people started to hear about that, and they started to bring their children to Milan and ask her, hey, would you be willing to teach my child how to read and write? So one turned to two to five to 10. Within 2 years, she had over 220 children that she was teaching. So within this woman, she began to have a vision for what her life could become, and she poured it out into others. So last May, we had the grand opening of Mi Hogar Cristiano, Milan's brand new 2-story school that will now house 550 children. It'll have a state-of-the-art computer center that we're building with Microsoft and the First Lady of the country. But it's because of her, though. I mean, she is the star of the Esperanza story. And now it's kind of come full circle because Esperanza has become a part of her vision, whereas before she was a part of ours.
You really live in two different worlds. You're kind of in the glamorous pro baseball world, where I know you've been a color commentator for quite a long time. And then you spend a great amount of time in the slums of the Dominican Republic. It's an interesting life you live. Which world do you enjoy the most?
You know, I feel like I've been blessed to be able to do both of them. And I think the two actually go together because I feel like God's enabled me to use the platform of sports and my career in baseball to support the work that we do in the Dominican Republic, to really impact the lives of literally tens of thousands of people. I can't think of anything better that I would like to be doing.
Dave Valle, thank you so much for joining us today.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Dave Valle is a former pro baseball player and color commentator for the Seattle Mariners. He's also founder of Esperanza, a nonprofit organization in the Dominican Republic. Aid workers move around the world a lot. Just ask David Snyder. He's traveled as an aid worker and photographer to many different countries in Africa and in Asia. He says if you want to get a quick handle on a new city, talk to a cabbie. In this commentary, David tells us about a recent conversation he had with a cab driver in Johannesburg.
At the airport curb, my cab driver slips my bags into the trunk as I flop into the passenger seat, a long flight behind me. Easing into the driver's side, Jack drags the door closed, brings his meaty hands to rest on the wheel, and threads his way without haste into rush hour. To fill the time, I ask casual questions about the city, where I live for a time myself. Over the hour that follows, pieces of Jack's life emerge into the space between us. He was born in Soweto in 1966, but Jack's parents sent him to the countryside to escape the township violence in the bloodiest years of apartheid. He did okay there, he says, but the energy and spirit of Soweto would not let him go. Returning home after high school, he married and found work nearby. But his happy family life was short-lived. In 1992, his wife was killed in pre-election violence, leaving him with a 3-year-old daughter to raise. Jack earned what he could from a job with a small factory making stationery. Speaking of his daughter, Jack hints at much time spent away from home working, and of help from his mother-in-law. In between his words, there is an edge to his silence. I can't tell if it's memories of time lost or of chances wasted. Their bond, however, survived the years. Jack says that at 16, she got a tattoo that reads, "Never mind me, worry about my dad." When work at the factory ran out, Jack turned to driving taxis. In a decade behind the wheel, he says he's transported the heads of international aid groups, a famous Congolese pop singer, and a more famous American rapper. That young fellow they call 50 Cent, as Jack recalls. Like many who make their living from travelers, he reads people quickly, forms opinions deliberately, and offers them bluntly. No one can trust Nigerians, he says. Drunken British soccer fans are the worst passengers. Americans talk too much. Today, he guides tourists through the township, now a rainbow mix of tin-roofed shacks, modest homes, and even a scattering of mansions, as some rich black South Africans are drawn back to their roots. When we arrive at my hotel, I pay him by the red glow of the parking lights. Jack offers a card with his number, call him if I need a ride while I'm in town, and drives off to make his living from the strangers in the city.
David Snyder is an independent writer and photographer working for international aid groups. He's based in Baltimore, Maryland. Subsistence farmers in Guatemala live off the corn and beans they grow, so they always have food to eat. What they don't have is money for much of anything else. That was before Walmart came along. Trevor Snap reports.
At the local market, shoppers bargain for produce under a patchwork of brightly colored tarps. Men in cowboy hats and rubber boots lean against pickups loaded with vegetables and call out their wares. Humio Diaz stands next to a truck full of cabbage he brought in from his farm. He says he's selling at rock bottom prices and will have to throw out whatever he doesn't sell today. He adds cabbage is selling for better prices at other markets, but they're just too far away. 30 minutes to the south, another small farmer is having his own problems with his cabbage crop. Like Dia, Don Marcos Cuctul grows corn and beans to survive. But he grows crops like cabbage and squash for a little cash to buy necessities. Don Marcos peels back cabbage leaves to show brown holes left by butterfly larvae. This season, he says he's actually lost money on his cabbage crop because of this pest problem. And so many other farmers grew cabbage, the price at the local market has plummeted.
El mercado está bajo, el costo de esto.
The market is horrible now. If I can sell a cabbage head for a one-quetzal, I'll sell it. If they give 55 cents, I'll sell it. If they give 25 cents, it's better to let it rot. There are moments in life when you say, please God, will someone buy this?
Now, a new project is trying to help farmers like Don Marcos to earn a better living. The program, run by the humanitarian aid group Mercy Corps, teaches farmers to grow higher-value crops, like potatoes. It's called the Inclusive Market Alliance for Rural Entrepreneurs. Marwin Cruz works for the alliance. Under his guidance, Don Marcos will be planting his first crop of potatoes this week. If all goes right, in 4 months, they'll be on the shelves of a supermarket owned by Walmart. Yes, Walmart, the world's largest retailer.
There are more than 200 stores across the country, and they are expanding into the rest of Central America. So what this project offers is a package of technical assistance and guidance for the farmers to grow their crops and a market.
Walmart has agreed to pay the farmers 20% over operating costs for their produce. That deal will last for 3 years. At that point, it's hoped the farmers won't need any more help to grow high-quality produce. Walmart also donates money to the project, along with USAID. It hasn't been easy for Marwin Cruz to find farmers who want to be in the Market Alliance program. So far, about 325 farmers have enrolled, far short of the goal of 600. That might be chalked up to the strict quality control Walmart demands, as well as the protective equipment it requires farmers to buy. 78-year-old Don Marcos hopes it will all be worth it.
Ahorita estoy esperando. Now, I wait. I wait for the potatoes. That's my plan. That is, if God gives me life. If not, I'm off to the other world.
Don Marcos's potatoes could end up in a supermarket, like this one owned by Walmart in Guatemala City. Business here is brisk. The produce section overflows with vegetables and fruit. Although Walmart only entered the Central American market 3 years ago, it's now the largest retailer in the region. Walmart's corporate affairs manager, Marcio Cuevas, says he hopes the Market Alliance project will help rural farmers.
You are doing something that is socially responsible by trying to improve the living conditions of people in the rural areas in Guatemala, and it's good for us. But at the end, what is the most important thing for us is to have very good products at a very good price in our stores.
An alliance between development groups and a commercial enterprise like Walmart may be unusual. But the project's director, Douglas Oval, says it's more sustainable than typical development projects, which often create dependency.
Basically, this is a very innovative project with two original components. First, the fact that this is a market-driven production program. And the second one, that we actually developing entrepreneurs in the rural areas.
But critics of the program, like the group Walmart Watch, point to the company's long history of aggressively driving down its suppliers' prices. They say the same thing will happen with these farmers once the program ends. And Oval himself can't guarantee that Walmart will stick to its promise to pay 20% above cost after the three-year project is over.
I don't know if we're going to keep doing it like that. That's going to be, at the end of the day, left among the farmer and Walmart. Our wish or hope is that it continues that way.
That's also the hope of Raul Cantarac, the manager of a 20-member farming association. Cantarac stands in a large greenhouse full of tomato seedlings as a worker waters the neat rows. 2 months ago, they sold their first tomatoes to Walmart.
No son cantidades grandes porque el control de calidad.
We didn't sell too much because the quality Walmart asked for was hard to reach. But the price is good because it is consistent. The local market changes a lot depending on what people are growing.
In 3 years, he says, he and his fellow farmers hope to sell every tomato they grow to the company. Later in the day, Don Marcos takes a break from his fields and heads back to his house, where ranchero music plays on a boombox. I ask him if he thinks growing cash crops exclusively for Walmart is risky.
What sort of crop is risky and what isn't? You have to experiment.
In his almost 8 decades, Don Marcos has lived through wars and coups, droughts and recessions. So he says he's hedging his bets.
We will always grow a little of everything. This is what we do. We won't only work with Walmart. We will always sell to the local market.
Walmart has been buying produce from small farmers throughout Central America for a number of years, but the program here in Guatemala is the only one reaching out to the poorest and least established farmers, like Don Marcos. If it's successful, Walmart plans to expand the project throughout the region. But for now, the company, along with the farmers here, must wait for the potatoes to grow.
That was Trevor Snapp reporting from Guatemala. Walmart and other big stores are helping out closer to home, too. We end our show today with this Globe at a Glance. The financial crisis is hitting many people hard. It's not just banks and automakers who are suffering. Food banks are struggling, too. That's because more and more people are looking for assistance in these tough times. And donations are down at food pantries all across the country. The leading hunger relief organization in the country is called Feeding America. Each year, it provides food for millions of Americans. The charity receives more than 2 billion pounds of donated food and groceries each year. Most of that is canned or packaged food. A while ago, Walmart announced that it would donate 90 million pounds of fresh food a year to Feeding America. Walmart has been reporting better than expected sales as cash-strapped Americans visited the discount store in droves looking for cheap deals. In this time of crisis, Feeding America is relying on donors like Walmart, Kroger, and Kraft to come through for it, so it can come through for the hungry. That's our Globe at a Glance, and that's the end of our show. If you'd like to hear more or see pictures of some of our stories, go to our website, worldvisionreport.org. I'm Peggy Wehmeyer. Thanks for listening.
This program is produced with funding from World Vision. The views expressed in this show are not necessarily those of the organization.